Yeah, good morning. So no class next week. And then we'll start with presentations the week after. And maybe I'll say the 2 weeks after. It's probably more correct. If I don't have enough to fill in the whole 3 hours, I don't think so. So some people have some problems with whatever it is. It's May 2nd. So if you can't fill the 3 hours, then I'll just do perhaps half presentations, half I tell something, and same the week after. But then I hope that will be it, because then I'm running out of time. Yeah, so at the end of last class, I started to hint at what the triangulated category is like, and I want to do it in a more systematic way today. And to do so, I just need to tell you a few more things about complexes to begin with. And one thing that could have been done much earlier is the so-called diagram lemmata. So these are some basic properties, essentially, of abelian categories that are very useful. And so the first one, or the one I want to start with, it's called the Fife lemma. And I'll just write down what the question is, and then we will figure out what the answer should be. So assume you have two five-term exact sequences. So the AI and BI in an abelian category. And we are given morphisms F0, F1, F2, F3, F4. And so the basic question here is how to decide when the one in the middle is an isomorphism, if you know enough about the morphisms on the side. So the question is, when is F2 an isomorphism? And before I even formulating the result, let me just indicate to you the kind of reasoning that you use. So clearly to say, and I will assume also for simplicity that I can deal with elements, so that let's say you are in a category of modules, if you like. So what does it mean? It means that F2 has to be an epi and a monomorphism. So let's say we want to try to prove F2 is a monomorphism. So let me do it over here, or maybe let me do it in color. Let's say we have some x in here that goes to 0. Now, clearly, without any further assumptions, we can't say much more about it. But one thing we know is that if it goes to 0 here, it certainly also goes to 0 in A3. And so now let's assume we know that F3 is an isomorphism. So then this would mean that the only choice we have where this could come from must be 0. In other words, because of the things are supposed to commute, it means that x goes to 0. So yes, of course, the basic assumption here, which I didn't write down, so top and bottom are exact, and moreover, all squares commute. So let's assume F3 is an isomorphism. Then we know that X being in the kernel of F2 means that X must be in the kernel of the map from B2 to B3, because the row on the sequence on the bottom is exact. That means that X must come from some Y in B1. Now, again, so far nothing has been forced, so let's look what happens if we go up here. So let's assume, again, that F1 is an isomorphism as well. Or maybe not for the moment. So we'll just look where this element goes. So we'll go to some Z. Now, because of the commutativity of this square, we know that this Z maps to 0, and because the top row is exact, we know it comes from some object, some element W in A0. But now you see, if we had that F0 is an epimorphism, we write it like this, then we would know that there is some V here which maps onto W, maps onto Z, and because of the commutativity, well, we cannot say that this maps to Y, except if we were to know that F1 is injective, right? Because otherwise, all we would know, starting from V, that this way around we go to Z, this way around we go to Z, but to be sure that the image of a V in B1 is Y, well, then we have to make sure that Z has only one preimage. But so let's assume we have that as well, that F1 is a monomorphism, then we know that V goes to Y, but the bottom row is a complex, so that would mean that V goes to Y, so Y is a boundary, and thus Y has to go to 0. So the conclusion then is that X must be 0. So let me formalize that here. So what we just saw is, if we have the following three things: F2 is an isomorphism, And actually, did we really use that? No. So let me retrench for a moment and let's repeat the argument. So what would we want? We want to see, well, what does it mean that F2 is a monomorphism? So we say, well, let's assume we have an X which goes to 0. Then it certainly goes to 0 here, and to make sure that X then has to go to 0 in B3, all we need actually is that F3 is a monomorphism. So let's say F3 is a monomorphism. And so I'll write down what this means. So this means, by this square, that X maps to 0. That is, so F2 of X equals 0 implies that, well, let me call this something. Let's call this D. Let's say D2 implies that D2 of X is 0. Right? So this is just the commutativity of this diagram, together with the fact that we assume that F3 is a monomorphism. So this means that D2 of X is 0. This means there exists a Y in one step back in B1, such that, I'll give this morphism a name as well, D1 of Y equals X. So next thing is that follows also from here that F1, so Z, which we define to be F1 of Y, so now I need to label these maps as well, satisfies delta 1 of Z equals 0. Thus, because the top row is exact, there exists a W in A0 such that partial 0 of W equals Z. So in other words, from just the assumption that F3 is a monomorphism, we can track all the way back to A0. And so now, if we assume that F0 is an epimorphism, then this gives us that there exists a V such that F0 of V equals W. And if F1 is a monomorphism, then it means that D0 of V equals Y, because the D0 of V and Y both map to Z, but F1 is a monomorphism, so these two must be the same. But this implies that X, which is D1 of Y, equals D1 D0 of V equals 0. And so we'll see that we get, in total, the conclusion, therefore, F2 is a monomorph. So, let me draw this slightly more schematically by just not putting labels there, just drawing the arrows. So this is exact, and everything commutes. So every square commutes. And so if you pictorially say what we have, so if this morphism is a monomorphism, this one is a monomorphism, and this one is an epimorphism, this implies that this one is a monomorphism. So the key thing here really is it's sort of plausible that if you want this to have a monomorphism, that the ones next to it should be a monomorphism, but that's not good enough. You also need then that the one further to the left is an epimorphism. So now let's assume you want this to be an epimorphism. Well, you simply dualize everything. Instead of, so think of this diagram upside down, and what does it mean that, this, for example, this morphism going down is a monomorphism in the opposite category? That means that this one here is an epimorphism. Similarly, that this one here is an epimorphism. And now in the opposite category, this morphism, of course, corresponds to this one. So you need that this here is a monomorphism. And if you have these three things, then you can conclude that the one in the middle is an epimorphism. So maybe I'll write it down once again. So F3, F1 mono, F0 epi implies F2 mono. And so the dual statements, well, remember that F3 and dually would correspond to this and this, but so F3, F1 epi and F naught becomes F 4 mono implies F 2 is epi. And clearly, if you combine the two, so you want that F 2 is both a mono and an epi, i.e. an isomorphism, well, if you look at this, this means if F 3 and F 1 are isomorphisms, F0 is an epimorphism, F4 is a monomorphism, then F2 is an isomorphism. So in other words, if, and so I'm even shortening it further by dropping the exact sequences, if you have this is an isomorphism, this is an isomorphism, this one is surjective or monomorphism, an epimorphism, this one is a monomorphism, then these things altogether imply that the one in the middle is an isomorphism. And so this statement is usually called the five lemma. Right? You have five terms, five morphisms, and knowing that the immediate neighbors are isomorphisms and that the one further out to the left is an epi, to the right is a mono, that implies the one in the middle is an isomorphism. And special case, you see, let's assume that top and bottom were short exact sequences. In other words, the outer terms were just zero. Right? A naught and A 4 were zero, and similarly in the bottom. So here we have F 2, here we have F 1, and here we have F 3. And of course here the outside, this is just, there's only one morphism from 0 to anywhere or into 0, and of course these are isomorphisms to begin with. So what does our diagram say? Well, it's the five lemma say, it says, well, if the two outer ones are monomorphisms, then the one in the middle is a monomorphism, similarly for epimorphisms. And thus also for isomorphism, something which we have used several times in the past, if F1 and F3 are isomorphisms, so necessarily is the one in the middle. So this is the five lemma. The next one could say is really at the basis of homology theory, sort of very basic statement, and are formulated in a way that is normally you won't find in a book, but I'll build it up like I did this one, and then I state the form that usually you find in the books. So the situation is really this. Let's assume you are given this kind of situation, together with the triple composition is zero. W, V, U equals zero. I mean, it's a little bit grandstanding, but in a sense, this is a reformulation of what's called the snake lemma in view of the lemma by Baylinson, Bernstein, and Deligne in triangulated categories, and I just want to show you where these things come from. So I start with a slightly strange formulation, but trying to eliminate the basic stuff. So the basic thing is really you have three composable morphisms such that your total composition is zero. And so what can we get from there? Well, first of all, we can, and that's why I started writing it this way, we can take here the kernel of W And we can take here the co-kernel of U. And by definition, that means that the bottom and the top are exact sequences. Now, because of the assumption, we have that this total composition is zero, so it means that the morphism W composed with V, if composed with U, is zero. So in other words, there exists a morphism, an induced morphism here. Call it V prime. And that's unique. Well, that's a universal property of the co-kernel. And dually, because UV, viewed as a morphism from A to C, if composed with W is zero, means that it factors uniquely through the kernel. Okay. And so normally one starts the snake lemma by starting with, by stating first the a diagram like this. So you have this kind of truncated exact sequence, which is exact on the right on top, and then truncated exact sequence, which is exact on the left on the bottom, and morphisms from top to bottom. So what's the next thing we can do? Well, we can form the kernel of V prime. Nothing wrong with that. Similarly, we can form the co-kernel of V double prime. We can as well form the kernel of V, and the kernel of V double prime, and similarly the co-kernel of V and the co-kernel of V prime. So nothing dramatic happened here. We just filled in a few more data that we could. Now the kernel, that's a functor, so this induces morphisms between the relevant kernels and the relevant co-kernels. And that's, again, the check is, again, the same as as before. For example, if you want to see that there, what is a morphism from the kernel of V to the kernel of V prime? Well, if you go from the kernel of V all the way to D, well, then the composition of these two vertical morphisms is zero by definition of what the kernel is. So this, you get zero here, so in particular you get zero here, which means that this zigzag from B to co-kernel of U to D is zero, which means that the morphism from the kernel of V to the co-kernel of U is composed with V prime is zero. In other words, this map here factors uniquely through the kernel of V prime. And so again, these morphisms are all uniquely determined by the rest. So far nothing has happened. The real new thing is that there exists, and that's where the name snake lemma comes from, a morphism from here to here. Naturally, we'll call it delta. So here is the snake lemma. So assume WVU equals zero in some abelian category. Then there exists a morphism delta from the kernel of V prime to the co-kernel of V double prime, such that and that's, of course, a crucial thing. If you look at the snake, this is exact, such that the sequence kernel V double prime, kernel V prime, to co-kernel V double prime, to co-kernel V prime is exact. And delta is often called the connecting homomorphism. Because it's sort of, or connecting morphism, I should say. Because it sort of connects the sequence of the kernels with the co-kernels. And another variant you usually find is if U was a monomorphism, so in other words, the top row was a short exact sequence, then this morphism between the kernels is a monomorphism as well. So in other words, you can put a zero at the right end. If, on the other hand, you had a zero here, in other words, the bottom row was exact at the right, then this implies that the sequence of the co-kernels is exact at the right, and so you can extend this here on the right. And which of these various variations you can pick now is given in any book that varies. But the real crux is the stuff in white. The rest is sort of just add-ons. Okay, so I'll put this diagram up because it's already confusing enough. And let's see what this delta is. So, let me draw this piece of the diagram. Let's just see what happens. Well, let's say we start with some x in the kernel. Well, we simply map it into the next term, so that gives us some y. However, this is an epimorphism. So in other words, there exists some z in B that maps to y, and then we can send z to v of z, and now you see, because x was in the kernel of v prime, y will go to 0 in D, right? Because y is the image of x, and x was in the kernel of v prime, so it goes to 0. But that means that v of z goes to 0, and thus it comes from the kernel. So there exists something here. Well, let's wrap around the alphabet. So there exists some element in the kernel of W which maps to V of Z. And so, maybe I'll say because it exists. So there is something that maps to V of Z, and then we can chase A down into the co-kernel of V double prime, and this one we define to be delta of X. So it's really like a staircase, right? Go down to the right, down to the right, down. Now, of course, we need to see that this is well defined. After all, there are two existence statements here. First case, we say there exists a Z which maps to Y. And let's see the other one here. Well, because it's a kernel, the A is unique. So there is no choice here. But there is definitely a choice in the Z. And so let's assume we would have chosen some Z prime. Well, then, that means that Z minus minus Z prime, it goes to zero in the co-kernel of U. So in other words, it comes from something here. So it would follow there exists some element, let me call it alpha. Which would map to Z minus Z prime. But then you see, doesn't really matter. So it would disturb our A here. Because if we were to do the same, instead of starting with Z here, we were start with Z prime, took V of Z prime and chose the corresponding A prime here, well, the two would differ by alpha. But because alpha sits in A, if you project into the co-kernel of V double prime, they both give the same element B. And thus, that is the fact that delta of X is well defined. It does not depend on the choice of the pre-image of Y in here. So let me again write it here. So X, we start with X in the kernel of V prime, then let's say, I didn't give these morphisms name, so this maps to Y in the co-kernel of U, and then there exists some Z in B that maps to Y. And then V of Z, which is an element in C, maps to zero in D. Thus, there exists a unique A in the kernel of W that maps to V of Z. And delta of X is, by definition, B, the image of A in the co-kernel of B double prime. And so, statement is that, so there were following statements, that delta is well defined. I indicated that. And secondly, of course, the exactness. Now, for example, let's convince ourselves that if we map delta X one step further into the co-kernel of V, that it necessarily goes to zero. Well, this is just sort of completing this diagram here, because you see, by construction, B will have the same image in here as does V of Z. But this is a cocardinal of phi. So both z's go to 0. Now you can, what would exactness mean at this stage? Well, it would mean, assume, forget about the delta x, and it's just reading the whole diagram backwards. Assume you have b in the cocardinal of v double prime, which goes to 0 in the cocardinal of v. We have to show that b is of the form delta of something. That's saying it's exact at this place. Well, what is it the delta of? Well, we start with b, then there exists some a in, we can lift it back to some a, we can map the a to something here, which goes to 0 by assumption, thus it comes from an from some element up here, so we map it over here, it goes to 0 there because the bottom row is a complex, thus this must come from some element x up here, and that is to say b is delta x for some x. So exactness at cocardinal v double prime, read the construction backwards. Third, exactness at the kernel of V prime. Well, what do you suggest is the cheapest proof for that? Huh? Yeah. It's just dual of, this is a dual to 2. So don't really need to prove it. You can, of course, prove it by hand, but it's not necessary. Any questions? Yes? Yes, I'll get to this later. Okay, so one corollary of this, and that's sort of perhaps the basic corollary, I put it in quotation marks because it needs a little bit more work. It's not completely obvious, but as you will see, it's just really a diagram chase. If 0 to C double prime to C prime to 0, let's say F and G, is a short exact sequence of complexes over some abelian category. So what does that mean? That means, in detail, if you write out these things as complexes, it means, of course, that all the squares commute. That's just saying you have morphisms of complexes. And it means that each row, so short exact sequence of complexes means each row is exact in this, if you display it like this. So if you have such a short exact sequence of complexes, then there exists a morphism of abelian of a morphism delta from the homology or cohomology of C prime to the homology or cohomology of C double prime shifted by 1, such that, and I like cohomology better than homology, so I'll write it down in cohomological terms, such that the sequence H I C double prime H I of F H I C H I C prime H I of G delta I H I of C double prime shifted by 1, but this is H I plus 1 of C double prime goes to H I plus 1 F into H I plus 1 C goes to by H I plus 1 G H I plus 1 C prime, etc., is an exact sequence. Of course, in the given abelian category. And this is the so-called long exact sequence in cohomology, defined by a short exact sequence of complexes. Now, what does this have to do with the snake lemma? Well, we simply isolate out two rows here in this short exact sequence of complexes. And I apologize because I put the indices here downstairs. Here I put them upstairs. I don't want to put them upstairs here because it collides with the primes. Well, bear with me here. So, let's say we look at two rows in this morphism of complexes, two consecutive ones. And then, remember how we define the homology of a complex. It's the cycle that is the kernel of the differential modulo the boundaries. So if we write this as D prime, D and D double prime, then here the kernel is just the cycles of D prime. So these are the I cycles of D prime. This is the kernel. And similarly, over here, and of course, same thing with the other two. So here we have the I cycles of D as the kernel, and here we have the I cycles of D double prime. And because we have a zero here at the left end, so we will have a zero up here as well. And so we do the same thing with the co-kernels. And again, because we have a zero at the right-hand side on the bottom, we get a zero here. And so this is a perfect setup for the snake lemma, because we have two exact sequences and morphisms between them. Here we have the kernels, and here we have the co-kernels. Thus, we have this morphism delta sitting here. And so to complete, aside from the routine verification that you have exactness sort of at the irrelevant terms at the cohomology of C, to complete the exactness at the source and target of this connecting homomorphism, we'll just need one more observation. Namely, we need that the cohomology at this stage, so now I write it as homology, so claim that the homology, I plus first homology of C double prime is a subobject that sits inside the co-kernel of D double prime. That's the first claim. And the second claim is that delta, the image, on all the cycles, indeed, instead of mapping into the co-kernel D double prime, it already maps into the corresponding homology. So how do you see the first claim? Well, go one step further in the complex. Because it's a complex, D double prime composed with the differential behind it is zero. So claim, so the first claim, so we have that D double prime composed with D double prime is zero. That's because C double prime is a complex. But that means that this morphism, D double prime, factors uniquely through the co-kernel of D double prime. There exists a unique morphism here. And let's call this, I don't know, D double prime tilde. So there exists a unique D double prime tilde from co-kernel D double prime to C double prime, I plus 2. And so the correct statement is that the kernel of D tilde double prime is the homology. Remember, in the original definition, we said if we have a complex, we take the kernel modulo the image. Well, what we are saying here is you can turn it around. This is just a dual version. You take the co-kernel and then the kernel. Same thing. So that gives the first claim. And now one needs to check through the diagram to see that indeed delta takes on its values in here. Moreover, sort of the final claim is that delta restricted to the boundaries is zero. So in other words, if something in here comes already from the previous stage, well, that's easy to see for just from the way delta is constructed, this letter process. If it comes from one step back, then the element in here is zero. But that means, so claim 2 and 3 taken together means delta induces the morphism from the quotient to the homology of C double prime. And what is this quotient? This quotient is just the ith homology of C prime. And so that is how, from the snake lemma, you first of all get the definition of this morphism, and then similar kind of diagram chase as we did up there will establish the exactness at all the relevant places. Okay. Now here comes the final. So I think of them as really three. Of course, there are many more diagrams you can talk about. So we talked about the five lemma, we talked about the snake lemma, and the last one I want to mention here is the so-called care-co-care lemma. And many people dismiss it because in many textbooks it's not explicitly stated for the reason, well, for various reasons. One of the reasons is that it can be seen as, again, a corollary of the snake lemma if you prove it in the right way. However, in connection with triangulated or derived categories, one could argue that this indeed is the most important one of the diagram lemmas. And what does it say? Well, it says the following. Assume you have two composable morphisms. So a triangle like this. Well, then you can, because we are in an abelian category, you can look at the kernels and the co-kernels of these various maps, morphisms. So we have A, F, B, G, C morphisms in an abelian category. Don't say anything about the composition, just that it is defined. So, now let's look at the kernels. Well, clearly, we can form the kernel of F. We can form the kernel of GF. And we can form the kernel of G. Moreover, it is easy to see that we get induced morphisms like that. Let me show you, and it's even exact, monomorphism here. Let me show you this one here. Well, what does it mean that something is in the kernel of F? It means that under F it goes to zero. Well, if it goes to zero under F, then it certainly goes to zero under composition, thus it maps to the kernel of GF. And clearly, because both are subobjects of A, if you have two different elements in the kernel of F, well, they stay different as elements of the kernel of G. So these are canonically induced morphisms. Right? Similarly, you see, if you have something which goes to zero under GF, well, then its image under F goes to zero under G. Which is to say, if you have something which collapses to zero under the composition, well, then its image, so this is just really induced by F. Let me call it F bar. And the dual picture is, well, we take the co-kernel of F, we take the co-kernel, sorry, I forgot to add zero here, of course. We get the co-kernel of F, the co-kernel of GF, and the co-kernel of G. And again, the morphism G induces a morphism between the co-kernels, and there's a canonical induced map between the co-kernel of GF to the co-kernel of G, and this map is an epimorphism. And so here, you can just take the composition of these two morphisms, the map from the kernel of G into B out to the co-kernel of F. So this is just a composition. In other words, this triangle here commutes. Nothing new. But the statement is the sequence, and again I call this delta, the sequence, well, I should grant myself some more space. Zero to the kernel of F to the kernel of GF to the kernel of G to the co-kernel of F to the co-kernel of GF to the co-kernel of G to zero is exact. Let me connect this to what we just did via the following example. Assume GF is zero. So in other words, the composition of the two is zero. So we have this situation. Well, A, B, C. Now, here we got still the kernel of F, but the kernel of zero is A itself. And what's the kernel of G? Well, so the kernel of G sits up here. Here we have the co-kernel of F. And the co-kernel of GF, well, that's zero, so that's just C itself. And the co-kernel of G. And here we have this morphism, delta. Now, you see, if you think of this as being a part of a complex, because after all, GF is zero, then these here are the cycles and F bar of A, these are the boundaries. That means that the co-kernel, so the kernel of G, of course, are the cycles at B. F bar of A are the boundaries at B. Thus, the kernel of G modulo F bar of A is isomorphic to the homology at B. But that's also isomorphic to the image of delta because the sequence is exact. So I can, if I take the epimonofactorization of delta through its image, then I see that the image of delta is the same as this co-kernel, which is a homology, is the same as this kernel. And that was what was claimed in the previous corollary there. So this is isomorphic to the kernel of G bar, which sits inside the co-kernel of F. Right? So this is the co-kernel of the differential. G bar is a map induced by the differential. And the kernel of that induced map is, again, the homology or cohomology. Now, here's a very puzzling exercise, something which is creates no end of confusion. So here's an exercise. Take V, a vector field, a vector space over a field. Take sigma from V tensor V to V tensor V, the switch. In other words, this is the map which sends V1 tensor V2 to V2 tensor V1. Just a map which switches around the two factors. So, first of all, I claim that the identity minus sigma composed with the identity plus sigma equals zero, and that's also true in the other direction. That's just saying that sigma is an involution. Sigma square is the identity, right? If you switch around twice, you get the same thing back. And now apply the Kerr-Kocher lemma to both sides and tell me what are the terms you find. So let's do one of them. So the exercise is to interpret the Kerr-Kocher lemma for either composition. So let me show you what I mean. Let's say we'll do the left one. So we'll take the identity plus sigma, and we'll take the identity minus sigma. All right. So let's look at the kernels. So what's the kernel of the identity plus sigma? Well, let me write it out. So an element, so we are looking for some element, and I'll write it xi tensor yi, some finite sum in V tensor V, and if we apply the identity plus sigma to it, while applying the identity, of course, we get simply this element back, and so we add the switched one, where we switch all the factors. And so what we want is that this is equal to zero, so this sum equal to zero. Or, as Cantaro is saying, if I take some omega in V tensor V, so a two tensor, what is it saying? That the identity plus sigma on dub omega is zero. Well, that's the same thing as to say that omega is equal to minus sigma omega. So if I switch, I get the opposite. So these are the anti-symmetric tensors. So let me write them here as anti 2 in V. Now, because we have 0 here, the kernel, of course, is simply V tensor V. And the anti-symmetric tensors sit in there. Now, what's the kernel here? Well, this is saying that we take a 2 tensor omega, and that omega equals sigma of omega. So these are the symmetric tensors. And you see I'm hesitating because what I write down, that's usually not the notation for this thing. So let me, maybe I write it out. Symmetric 2 tensors in V. And so the identity plus sigma, that's a symmetrization map. Right? It takes a 2 tensor and adds its switched one to it. So what you end up with is definitely a symmetric tensor. Now, what's the quotient here? What does it mean? I take V tensor V modulo all symmetrized tensors. How do you call those? No. Alternating 2 tensors. Because what does it mean? In terms, it means that V1 tensor V2 maps to V1 tensor V2 plus V2 tensor V1. So you definitely divide out by this. So in the quotient, it is skew symmetric. However, you see, if you take V tensor V, this maps to 2 times V tensor V, not to V tensor V itself. So you divide out, so you anti-symmetrize. But it is not alternating. It does not kill the square of V, only twice the square of V. Okay? So these are also called the skew symmetric 2 tensors. Here, of course, we have again V tensor V. And here, what is the quotient here? We take all the 2 tensors, so we divide out by the relation V1 tensor V2 minus V2 tensor V1. So in other words, in the quotient, it doesn't matter in which order you write these. So that's called the second symmetric power of V. So now, to confuse everything further, so here we have the anti-symmetrization map. So what's the kernel from V tensor V onto the second symmetric power? So in other words, what's the image of this map? So if I factor this through its image. What's the kernel of a canonical map from V tensor V to the second symmetric power? Well, that's the second exterior power. And what is this? This is the same as V tensor V divided by the first relation plus these. Not twice these, but these. So, I know, I have successfully run myself out of space again, so let me do it over here. So, just to repeat it, so sim2 of V is by definition V tensor V divided by the subspace generated by v1 tensor v2 minus v2 tensor v1 for v1, v2 in v. And I mean the K-linear subspace generated by those. Lambda 2v is v tensor v divided by v tensor v for v and v. And that includes this relation here, as I leave you as an exercise. Just expand v1 plus v2 tensor v1 plus v2 by the binomial formula and use that the squares are already zero. When it has an exact sequence, 0, 2, lambda 2v, 2v tensor v, 2 sim 2v, which of course sends v1 wedge v2, which is a class of v1 tensor v2 in here. So this is a class of v1 tensor v2, maps to v1 tensor v2 minus v2 tensor v1. And notice that this map indeed kills v wedge v, because if you take v tensor v minus v tensor v, that's obviously zero. So, similarly, we could ask ourselves, what is sort of the dual picture, what is the image of this map? So where does this factor through? Now mind you, here we had, these are the anti-symmetrized tensors, but again, it means that we took so the anti-symmetrized tensors were the anti-symmetric tensors, these were those where omega is equal to minus sigma of omega, and we divide those out. And these you call the alternating two tensors. And so what's the image or the homology? What's the homology here? Well, it's easy to see if you look at this side. It's the kernel of this map, which is the same as the kernel of this map. Well, there's two skew symmetric tensors that was dividing out by the relation V1 tensor V2 plus V2 tensor V1, and this one was where we also divided out all the squares. So the kernel of these two maps are just all those squares. It's generated by the squares, because they go to zero here, whereas in here only two times the squares is zero. So what you find in here are all the squares that are annihilated by two. So the homology, so the image of delta, consists of V tensor V such that 2 times V tensor V equals 0 in end of it. So it's usually, if 2 is a unit, it's not there. It's 0. If 2 is a unit, then this is an isomorphism, or even just a non-zero divisor. But if you are in characteristic 2, or 2 is not a zero divisor more generally, then there is indeed homology here. And in a much more fancy way, one can say that this is the same thing. Well, you think of sigma as generating the action of a group of order 2, right? Sigma switches, and sigma squared is the identity. So you can think of V times of V as being a module over the group rank of the group as two elements. So this is the same thing as the first cohomology of the group as two elements on V times of V, where the action of the group is just given by the switch map. So you see that even such an innocent example like switching around two tensors leads to some quite intriguing. It defines the kernel, co-kernel sequence, defines all this kind of bilinear objects that you encounter for symmetric forms, alternating forms, quadratic forms, etc. Yes? Well, you can think of it, it's the H1, really, of the group ring of the group as two elements on V tens of V. Or it's the same thing, if you like. It's X2 over K, no, X1, sorry, over the group ring of the group as two elements from K into V tens of V. That's another way of thinking of it. So this is the whole gadget which creates a difference between symmetric forms and quadratic forms. Maybe you have never encountered it so far, but you will see that if you there's a subtle distinction which has to do with the role of two between symmetric maps and quadratic forms. Anyway. So this is really worthwhile to contemplate in some more detail and also to write down what happens on the other side if you interswitch the two. What are the various things that are defined here in this diagram as the co-kernels and kernels? Well, that's already in the picture. And what is the meaning of this morphism delta? All right. Now, I want to make one final comment on these diagram lemmas, especially on the snake lemma, and that will then really be the beginning or the basis for the yoga of triangulated categories. And then I'll have a short break and I'll show you how it all fits together. And so you see, the snake lemma, which is still up here on the board, has this somewhat cumbersome feature that it looks like you will never be able to write down the map delta because you have to go through this letter, and who knows, do you have any canonical choices there? What's the practical use of it? And there's one crucial case where the choice is yours and things become easy. And that is the case of most importance. So let me go back to sort of explicit connecting homomorphism. And it is really what you think it should be. Namely, let's assume, and start a bit deeper, let's assume we have indeed short exact sequence, and similarly here, and you will see cross, so it's utterly obvious, namely assume that the top row splits. It's a split exact sequence. Remember, what did it mean? So then I'll call this U, and then I'll call this U prime. And so we assume that it splits. Well, remember, this means that we have a section for U prime. In other words, we have that U prime S equals the identity of the co-kernel on the co-kernel of U. And then we can also complete the picture by putting the retract here, and we have given that RU is the identity on A, and moreover, we have that SU prime plus UR is the identity on B. And we talked about this, so these byproducts or split exact sequences. And clearly, if you look at the construction, then let me call this here I prime for the inclusion of the kernel, and let's call this P double prime for the projection onto the co-kernel. Then clearly, if you have a section, this means that you have a preferred choice here. You start from an X here, go down to the co-kernel, and now you somehow want to go up to B. Well, if you have a section, that's easy, right? So in that case, you can define delta to be, well, let's see if you have to start at the end, P double prime okay, let me, sorry. And assume you have also that the lower half splits. Because remember, you have two dotted arrows. There's this one and there's this one. This one is really not so critical because the A was uniquely determined by what happened here. But it still makes life easier if you assume that, let's say, we have a splitting here as well. So assume that we also have that sigma W sigma is the identity on D, etc. So we have both split exact sequences. Well, then, the delta is obvious, right? It is P double prime rho V S I prime. Go down here, go over here, go down, go over, go down. In particular, this applies to complexes in the following sense. So assume we have, again, a short exact sequence of complexes. And we said this was F and this was G. That is what's called semi-split. And So what does that mean? It means that there exists morphism S from C prime to C, but it's not necessarily a morphism of complexes. It is just a zero chain in the Hom complex. In other words, we have the GS is the identity on C prime, but S not necessarily the morphism of complex. This corresponds in the picture above that we do not require that S and sigma are compatible. In other words, we do not care whether the sort of the backwards square, which consists of VV prime, S and sigma, commutes. That's not necessary at all. So if this is the case, then delta from the homology of C prime to the homology or cohomology of C double prime shifted by 1 is induced by the bracket, the differential on C and S. What does it mean? It means the following. You see, so this is just D, comma S. This is D, C, and S. So S goes back. And remember the definition of this bracket. So that's the differential here composed with S. And then D is of degree 1. That's a differential in the complex. S preserves the degree, so it's of degree 0. So if we switch the two, then we simply get minus S times the differential on C prime. And so what a kind of map is this? Well, this goes from C prime to C, if you like, and then 1 degree up, so it goes to C of 1. However, D of S equals 0, as you simply calculate, this means that D, comma S, the bracket, factors through F of 1. And this here gives then the connecting homomorphism. Well, I should say there are actually two statements here. So the first one, that this is 0, implies that D comma S is a morphism of complexes. And secondly, it factors through C double prime. So in other words, the delta comes from an actual morphism of complexes. Now here's a real beauty, and that's what's behind, for example, the theory of the Atiyah classes. You don't need that S is in the category itself. The only thing you need, so S could be in some category with more morphisms. Typical example is, if this were a sequence of vector bundles, say of algebraic or complex analytic vector bundles, and these were corresponding morphisms, then in that category you usually cannot find a section. But if you think of them as C-infinity, so smooth vector bundles, then you can find a section. And all you need is that this one, so only require this to be in the category. So the S itself doesn't have to be. Could be in some broader, larger thing. So that's really what's behind a lot of stuff in differential geometry, where you split the morphism surjection of vector bundles by some C infinity splitting, which is given by, for example, induced by some connection, and then the bracket gives you the connecting homomorphism in cohomology. So, now you see, this should ring a bell, because what does it mean if we write this down sort of in a more systematic way? We see yet again the same picture we saw last time with the horseshoe lemma and the mapping cones. Namely, we have C double prime, F, C, C prime, G, and now we have this map D, S going to C double prime shifted by 1. So we get a triangle and now, again, needs to be written down in detail, but like in the horseshoe lemma, you can turn around and can say, well, I can start with this morphism and reconstruct this piece. Because I have C prime and C double prime, so I have the two outer terms, and this complex in the middle is simply term by term, it's a direct sum of what is on the outside, and the differential is given by the two differentials on C prime and C double prime. Remember, we had this kind of triangular matrix where these two things came from the differentials on the end, and this piece here comes from this morphism. Now, it will not necessarily be exactly this complex here in the middle, but it will be homotopy equivalent to it. And that's a key issue. And the whole thing behind triangular categories. Start with a short exact sequence of complexes. You construct a morphism of degree 1, and this morphism of degree 1 reconstructs the exact sequence. So, and if you remember this interplay between the Yoneda extension groups and short exact sequences, you can as well think of this morphism as being the incarnation of the extension class. Okay, let's have a short break, and then I'll put it all together. Namely, so here's a remark. A short exact sequence of complexes, 0 C prime C C double prime to 0 over an abelian category, okay, over an abelian category is F and G is semi-split if and only if it is of the form, it is homotopy equivalent. And that means, i.e., isomorphic in the homotopy category, so let me give this abelian category a name, A, K of A, to a sequence zero X cone or Y cone of F to X of 1 to 0 for some morphism F from X to Y of complexes. And so that's just the formal statement of saying if you have a semi-split sequence, then you can sort of extend it here by a morphism delta from C prime to C double prime shifted by 1, and the middle term is given by the cone shifted of this extra morphism. And that's if and only if, because these sequences here, by definition, are semi-split, if you think back at the construction of the mapping cone. So that was the first remark, and there's a second one, which is sort of the silly case where the complexes X and Y are just really objects from your abelian category situated in the degree zero, say. So you think of X, you think of X as being a complex, so in degree minus 1, 0, 1, and Y, similarly, as a complex, and here's your morphism F. And then how does the mapping cone look like? Well, we said that the mapping cone, you shift this back here. There are no differentials on X and Y because there's too few terms, so the whole differential here becomes minus F. And this sequence here, so if we call it I and P, say, then I is just this morphism of complexes, and the projection to X of 1 is simply this map here. Right? This complex here is X shifted by 1, right? X shifted 1 place against the differential. So here, this is the sequence Y goes to the cone of F, goes to X of 1. And it's visibly semi-split because here you have the identity and here you have the identity. Now, what I wanted to say is, what is the long exact sequence in cohomology? Long exact sequence in cohomology. Well, let's start here. Then, of course, the cohomology is simply Y in degree 0, and there everything else is 0. What's the cohomology in degree 0 here? Well, it's just a co-kernel of minus F, which is same as co-kernel of F. So this here is H, let's call it cohomology, of this complex where Y sits in degree 0, goes to the co-kernel of F, which is H naught of the mapping cone of F. And then over here, there is no cohomology, so that's 0. So this is H upper naught of X of 1. And then beyond that, if you continue, it's all zeros, so there's nothing interesting. So what's a connecting homomorphism from H minus 1 of X of 1 to here? Well, H minus 1, that's just X. And the connecting homomorphism, as you can see easily, is simply going to be minus F. No, it's F. Why? Because here you have the canonical splitting, which is also the identity, and here you have the canonical splitting, which is the identity. And remember what we said. We said that the morphism, the connecting homomorphism from here to here, is going to be just the section going down, the section going down into cohomology. So it's given by minus F. And so what is then, what comes before? So we have now the cohomology here, which was 0. Here it was a co-kernel. Here it's Y. Here it is X. What is the cohomology here? Well, it's the cycles modulo the boundaries. The cycles are just the kernel of minus F, or it's the same thing, the kernel of F, and there are no boundaries. So we have the kernel of F, which is H minus 1 of the cone of F, maps to here. And then, of course, this complex Y doesn't have any cohomology in degree minus 1. And so you see what we have done. If you start with a single morphism, construct the mapping cone, and look at the long exact cohomology sequence, we simply get the sequence 0 goes to the kernel of F, goes to Y, goes to X by F, or minus F, goes to the co-kernel of F. So this basic setup you can reconstruct from this very simple yoga of mapping cones. And what these remarks are supposed to bring home to you is that instead of looking at short exact sequences, one might as well simply look at the mapping cone construction. And so that's what we're going to do. So, definition. Triangulated category consists of, first of all, an additive category D, an autoequivalence from D to itself, so in other words, it's an equivalence of categories from D to itself, and a collection of triples X, Y, Z, X of 1, called the distinguished triangles, subject to the following axioms. No, I better look it up so I get the right right numbering. So TR1, that just ensures that there are enough triangles. And it says, first of all, every morphism F from, or, well, U from X to Y occurs in a triangle. And I'll give the examples in a second. Moreover, the triangle X, the identity on X, 0, X of 1, is distinguished for every X. And the next one, which is sort of the four lemma, if in the commutative diagram, so we have X, U, Y, V, Z, W, X1, and another one, X prime, Y prime, Z prime, X prime of 1, we have A, B, C, A of 1. Oh, and sorry. So I'll write either T or one writes it as shift by 1. Sorry, should have said that. So if in the commutative diagram, top and bottom are distinguished triangles, and sorry, the other way around, I was jumping ahead. So if in this commutative diagram the top is distinguished and A, B, C are isos, then the bottom is distinguished. In other words, any triangle isomorphic to a distinguished one is distinguished. So if you have a distinguished triangle and another sequence, U prime, V prime, W prime, which relates to the original one in this way by isomorphisms, then the bottom is a distinguished triangle as well. So first point says there are enough triangles. Every morphism embeds into one. The second one is sort of a normalization piece. It says the identity, what the triangle looks like over the identity. And the last one is that anything which is isomorphic to a distinguished triangle is a distinguished triangle. By the way, an important piece here is the "er". No one says that this triangle is unique. That's generally false. So, we're just saying that every morphism somehow occurs in a triangle, but we do not say that it's a unique one. Okay, so that's the stuff about the what Hamming gives us at least some basic things about triangles. TR2 is also called the rotation action. And that says if x to y to z, x of 1 is distinguished, so is, well, here's sort of the complete version, then in the sequence z minus 1 minus w minus 1 x, y, z minus u of 1 y of 1 minus v of 1 z of 1 minus w of 1 x of 2 any three consecutive morphisms form a distinguished triangle. So, in other words, see, you can think of it as you have your basic triangle sitting here, but with it, you can shift to the left. This one is a triangle, or you can shift to the right. This one is a triangle. And so forth. The signs are clearly annoying, but necessary. Of course, this is one could get away with less. It would be enough to say, well, for example, just a shift to the right is again a triangle, and then by repeating the whole thing, you get this whole long sequence on both sides. But I like to write it out in this form because it makes things sort of come together more nicely, and it also sort of hints at the long exact sequence in cohomology, which is really behind this. TR3, the lifting of morphisms, and it is the derived version of the snake lemma, namely, sort of given, so I'll write down, so we have x to y to z to x of 1, and down here we have x prime, y prime, here we have f, g, f of 1, then there exists an h which makes everything commute. So, bottom and top are distinguished triangles. And this square here commutes. Then there exists such an H. And so this comes now back to this, what I mentioned earlier, Baylinson-Bernstein-Deligne lemma says that if you just give yourself sort of this middle composition here, so V prime, G, and U, which is 0, then you can fill in H, and F, but not necessarily unique. So that's the other version for it, but I'll come to this in a second, because from here it's not even clear yet that this composition is necessarily zero, as we will see in a moment. So, in other words, so distinguished triangles, GU equals U prime F, then there exists H such that HV equals V prime G, so makes this one commute and this one as well, so and W prime H equals F of 1 composed with W. So that's the third axiom. Now two more to come. And to understand the next one, I need to go back to the Kerr-Kocher lemma. And rewrite it in terms of complexes. So TR4 is also saying something about the composition of two morphisms and the associated distinguished triangles. Now I try to do this on this picture. And so what does it mean if you think of what I just said at the very beginning about mapping codes? So from this picture, we can construct triangles. Namely here, we'll put the mapping cone of G. Here, we put the mapping cone of GF. And I write the plus one because, of course, this morphism really goes to A of 1. And similarly here, we have the mapping cone of F and the morphism plus 1. And mind you that the kernel of G and the co-kernel of G are precisely the cohomology of the mapping cone of G, as you just showed you. And similarly, this exact sequence here is precisely the long cohomology exact sequence belonging to this. And so the key issue here is, let me see, that you see there is a composition of morphisms here. Maybe. Just this composition. And the statement is that there exists morphisms here such that the outer triangle is distinguished and these three are commutative. So, I know, this looks now terribly confusing. So let me redo it. So TR4, the octahedral axiom, says, and if you like, I'll do it with X, Y, and Z, but I still want to call it F, G, and GF. So just pair of morphisms in D. So G from X to Y. We have F from X to Y, G from Y to Z. Then we can And let's assume we have a triangle, a distinguished triangle here. Put it up here, and down here. So, this diagram here in the middle, of course, of triangle commutes. This one is distinguished. This one is distinguished. This one is distinguished. Then, up here, we'll just have the composition. So this one is commutes. And so the octahedral axiom says there exists one here, such that this commutes. There exists one here, such that this commutes. And moreover, the outside is distinguished. So you can think of this, hope you can see this, this is a projection out of one vertex of the octahedron. Right? One vertex of the octahedron sits at infinity, and then you take stereographic projection. Okay? You can see this? So one, from the midpoint of a face of the octahedron, right? So one face contains infinity, the outer one. So there are four commutative triangles and four distinguished ones. And thus the octahedral axiom is nothing but the Kerckhoff lemma. And then there is another axiom which sometimes is satisfied. So one says that D is a triangulated category with arbitrary direct sums. Then the axiom TR5 is that any set indexed direct sum of distinguished triangles is distinguished. But so this is sort of an extra axiom that not necessarily always satisfies. I hope so. Remember, think of this as being the mapping cone of G, for example. So then Z goes to the mapping cone, goes to Y of 1. Right? Similarly here, Y goes to the mapping cone of F, goes to X of 1. And down here, Z goes to the mapping cone of GF, goes to X of 1. So these plus ones are, the red ones are okay. And that forces the rest, right? Because, for example, the top one, this is a composition of a morphism of degree 1 plus a morphism of degree 0, so it's of degree plus 1. And here, if this is supposed to be commute, both these are of degree plus 1, so this must be of degree 0. All right? Okay, so of course the key example of the whole construction take A abelian and KA the homotopy category. Then KA together with the translation functor and together with the distinguished triangles XFY cone of F to X of 1. So what do you call it? I don't remember, I and P. So for all morphisms from X to Y, is a triangulated category. And because of the last point in TR1, we could replace this here by saying all semi-split exact sequences of complexes, because they are all homotopy equivalent to one of those. But it's sometimes easier, because here you have the explicit construction of the terms, where this is sort of just a property of the complex itself. And same thing also true for the subcategories, where you put some adornment here. So you take the complexes that are bounded in the direction of the differential, against the direction of the differential, or the bounded complexes themselves. Same thing, because the formation of mapping cones does not leave any of these categories. Now, just to show you how powerful the axioms are, although they don't really look like much, except that they probably look pretty strange if you haven't worked with them, here's a proposition. Well, okay, a few things. So if D, T, and if you like E, so this here is a collection of distinguished triangles, is triangulated, so is D op, T op, E op. So in other words, the whole setup is symmetric. That's sort of just, well, don't forget it. But second piece is more important. For any distinguished triangle, x, y, z, x, 1, and any object u in d, the sequence hom d u x hom d u y hom d u z hom d u x 1, etc. So obtained from applying hom du to this long exact sequence here in TR2, sorry, not exact, this long sequence to the sequence in TR2 is exact. I'll give you proof of this because it's so simple. So first thing, note, so by the rotation action, so by TR2, it suffices to prove exactness at one spot. Because, for example, at Y, if I want to prove it at Z, well, just shift the triangle first and then prove the same statement. Let's say, so e.g., at Y, here. Well, how do we do that there? So assume, so if G from U to Y is such that which one was that? UV. So that VG from U to Z is zero. Then just consider the following diagram. So we have X goes to Y, goes to Z, goes to X of 1, UVW. Here we take U. Here we have G. Now by assumption, the composition VG factors through U, and so we can make this into the standard distinguished triangle. So this one is distinguished by assumption. This one is distinguished by TR1. And by TR3, there exists some F filling in this diagram here. So that's by TR3 applied to the rotated version. So applied to the rotated triangle. But what does that say? Well, that says there exists an F such that G equals UF. In other words, we had G in here, which mapped to 0 there, and we just showed there exists some F here from U to X, which maps onto G, which maps to UF equals G. And that's what it means. In particular, corollary, in any distinguished triangle, the composition of two consecutive morphisms is zero. Namely, e.g., to see that VU equals zero, simply take U equal X. and look what happens to the identity of X. Then the identity of X goes to U, goes then to VU, and that's zero because this is an exact sequence. So, in a sense, you can think of this long display of a distinguished triangle. It's in particular a complex, right? The composition of any two consecutive morphisms is zero. But you can't take homology because the category is not abelian, only additive. And indeed, it doesn't have any homology in the sense that whatever you apply, you get a long exact sequence. So that's the first corollary. Second corollary is the same is true in the contravariant argument. That is, for every V and D, also hum D blank V transforms the sequence in TR2 into a long exact sequence. That's just a dual statement, obviously, to the one we have. So, just the dual statement. And as we said, that the dual of a triangulated category is triangulated. We are done. Okay. So, now let's link this back to what we have done earlier with Yoneda X. And to do so, I'll just need one more piece of notation, definition. A functor, an additive functor, f from D to A, from triangulated category to an abelian one, is homological if for every triangle, distinguished triangle, of course, UVW applying F to the long sequence in TR2, it is an exact sequence in A. So just write F in front of each of these terms here. That then gives you a sequence in A. It is, and the statement is it should be exact. So the example, and so one writes, Fi, upper I, for the composition F composed with T to the R. So, the typical example, if A is abelian, and you look at the functor H equals H naught from K of A to A, which assigns to any complex, remember the objects in K of A are complexes, so which H of a complex C comma D equals H naught of C comma D, it's zero's cohomology, this is a homological functor. And similarly, so are the representable functors. So if you take hom u blank, well, that satisfies this. So and indeed, this cohomological functor in the category for modules is representable. So this was example one. Example two, each hom d u blank viewed as a functor from D into the category of abelian groups is homological. That's just a statement of this proposition. If A happens to be the category of modules, let's say over some ring R, not necessarily commutative, then I claim that hom K of A from R considered as a complex concentrated in degree zero, this is just the same as H zero. It's just the same as taking cohomology. Why is that? Because, look, if you have any complex and you have the complex which has R concentrated in degree zero, so here you have C zero, C minus one, C one. What's a morphism of complexes here? Well, the only thing we have to worry about, so first of all, morphism from a ring is the same thing as the image of 1. So this is just some element x in C naught. To say that this diagram commutes is equivalent to say that dx equals 0. In other words, for this diagram to commute means that x has to be a cycle. And what does it mean? It's homotopic to zero. Well, it means that there exists a homotopy, which doesn't mean anything if you go through zero. That's still the zero map. But more precisely here on this side, this triangle says one goes to some y in C1, which maps to x under D. So these are the cycles. And x equal dy are the boundaries, and thus we see that, so that's the same thing as to say that the map defined by X is homotopic to zero, and so you see that these two functors are the same. So taking cohomology of a complex is the same thing, becomes representable in the homotopic category. Thus, H is representable on K of mod R. All right, so how do we tie it all together? proposition. So let A be abelian and set K naught of A inside K of A, the full subcategory, which is really the category of modules. It's just a subcategory of complexes concentrated with only non-trivial term in degree zero. So be the full subcategory consisting of all complexes with HI of C equals zero for I different from zero. Well, that's slightly, these are all complexes which have only homology in degree zero. So they look like resolutions of something, even though they might extend in both directions. So, then first of all, if A contains enough projectives, which we defined some time ago, then the functor H naught from K naught of A to A, which takes the complex and assigns to it its only cohomology, because the rest of it is zero, admits a fully faithful left adjoint, we'll call P, from A to K naught of A. And this adjoint assigns to M and A a projective resolution of M. More precisely, the co-unit of this adjunction and so what does that mean? That means we take first the right adjoint, which is H naught, and then the left adjoint, which is P, then there is a canonical, or in this case was M, there is a canonical morphism onto the given object, and this constitutes a projective resolution. Moreover, so there are various parts to this. No, it said M is an A. You see, H naught is a functor from complexes, particular complexes, into the abelian category, A. So the left adjoint, whatever adjoint, goes backwards, goes from A to these complexes. That would give you the co-unit. Would go from C to H naught of P of C. This would be the unit. The co-unit goes the other way. Goes from LR to the identity. If you check back. Yoga of adjoint functors. see, the functor P is only defined on A. So did I make a... Yes, I think you're right. H naught, so we start from a complex C. Sorry. Take H naught of C, which is in A, go back with P, and that maps to C. This is a projective resolution of this complex C, which has only one cohomology group. Thanks. Just misunderstood your question. Second part. So, assuming one, in other words, that A has enough projectives, then every short exact sequence, 0 to M prime to M double prime to 0. Now, again, alpha and beta instead of F and G is mapped to a unique distinguished triangle in K of A, which looks like you apply the functor P gamma P M prime of 1, where gamma is, of course, a homomorphism in K of A from PM prime, double prime, to PM prime shifted by 1. And this morphism gamma is precisely the morphism that you get from the horseshoe construction. And part three, the association where it starts from the short exact sequence in A, so every short exact sequence in A, of course, is mapped to a unique distinguished triangle in K of A. And then the association, you take such a short exact sequence, you assign to it this morphism gamma in the homotopy category, factors through x1 a from m double prime to m prime, and induces and provides a bifunctorial isomorphism from x1 over A, m double prime, m prime, to this group, K of A, P m double prime, P m prime of 1. And of course, finally, you have the dual statements. If A has enough injectives, what this means is that in this category, in this triangulated category of complexes, homotopy category of complexes, the uneta x simply become morphisms. So in the, and that's a whole key issue about triangulated categories, that extension groups can be replaced by actual morphisms. Extensions, classes are replaced by actual morphisms. Now I'm almost out of time, which means that I can't really talk about the proof of this. But not to finish this without sort of finally saying, what's happening? So, so this is a theorem, given a homological functor, F from D to A, it's theorem and definition, so we'll say set K, which is sort of to be thought of as a kernel of F, so set K, the full subcategory, of D such that F with any transpose restricted to K is zero. So these are the F acyclic objects. So if you think of the cohomology functor, it says for I equals 0, there is no cohomology, and there is none for any shift. So there is no cohomology whatsoever. These are the acyclic complexes, have no cohomology. Then, there exists a quotient D mod K, which is, and so instead of saying what is a quotient, I put it in question marks, in quotation marks, because it's not really a quotient, but it has the same property as a quotient. So it means that D mod K is a triangulated category. The projection that exists natural functor called the projection from D to D mod K that commutes with translation and preserves distinguished triangles, and moreover, any functor, any homological functor, e.g. F itself, such that any homological functor G, let's say, such that G composed with Ti on K equals 0 for all I, factors uniquely through D mod K. So you think of it like this. You have D, you have A. Here you have K, which is sort of all the stuff that goes to zero, not only under F, but also under all translates of F. And then there exists some projection onto some triangulated category here, which factors this and is closer. Right? Now, so then the final word, although even only the beginning of the real story, is if you do this, so e.g., you take K of A, and in it you take all the acyclic complexes. In other words, all the complexes which have no cohomology whatsoever, then the derived category of A is just this quotient. Now, this does not construct it for you, because we haven't said how you would obtain such a this universal construction. And also, there are, again, as usual in category theory, some set theoretic tiny problems with this, unless you have good control over your abelian category A. However, in view of the time, I'll have to stop here. I'll be happy to elaborate further on it in 2 weeks' time, when we can combine it with some presentations, if you like. Thank you very much.